From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And President Trump has given his first interview since firing FBI Director James Comey. He told NBC's Lester Holt that he was going to fire Comey whether or not his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, or Acting Deputy Rod Rosenstein recommended it. He also said he's been told by Comey that he was not being investigated. This was once during dinner with Comey and twice on the phone.
One case I called him, and one case he called me.
And did you ask, am I under investigation?
I actually asked him, yes. I said, if it's possible, would you let me know, am I under investigation? He said, you are not under investigation.
Earlier, Andrew McCabe, the man who replaced Comey as acting director, was asked about this by Republican Senator Richard Burr.
Did you ever hear Director Comey tell the president he was not the subject of an investigation?
Sir, I can't comment on any conversations the director may have had with the president.
NPR political editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
So every day, you know, we get a little something here. Your thoughts first on the president's claims. He said Comey told him first at a dinner, then on a phone call when Comey called him, and another where the president called Comey and said he asked him directly if he was being investigated. President Trump told Lester Holt all three times James Comey told him he was not being investigated. Now, there are people already questioning the ethics of a president calling an FBI director about an ongoing investigation. But what do you make of the president being so adamant about this?
Well, I mean, I think that that is the key point on the ethics of this. You know, it's a remarkable interview and a remarkable thing for a president to say that he called an FBI director and asked directly if he was under investigation. You know, Sarah Sanders, the spokeswoman from the White House, said yesterday that the president had been thinking about firing James Comey since November. You know, and I understand the president is trying to not say that this is anything related to the Russia investigation. But, you know, the reasoning that the president has given and this White House has given was that that this president had that it had to do more with the Hillary Clinton emails investigation. So that's kind of hard for a lot of people to swallow that that's actually what was going on.
Right. He also said today to Lester Holt, and there's apparently more of this interview coming, but he said he'd have fired James Comey without Rod Rosenstein's recommendation. We've been seeing reports that Deputy Rosenstein has been very upset that he was the one pointed to as the reason for the firing.
Right.
But to the Senate intelligence hearing, it was already scheduled. It would have been nothing out of the ordinary, but then we have the firing of James Comey, and suddenly all of Washington listening to every word from Comey's replacement's mouth. What did you learn from Andrew McCabe today?
Well, he contradicted what we've heard from the White House in saying that that morale at the FBI was not low. Was the White House had sort of used as an excuse to say, you know, first the reason was that he'd messed up the Hillary Clinton investigation. Then the reason is that morale was low at the FBI. And something seems amiss because that neither thing seems to pan out as McCabe had gone in and said, you know, no, morale, everybody had high confidence in James Comey.
McCabe also said he thought the Russia probe was highly significant. That completely contradicts President Trump's tweets earlier this week. It's a waste of time. It's ridiculous. It's taxpayers' money. When's it going to end?
Right. Not the small, you know, small investigation looking into Russia meddling. Clearly, this had been irritating this president. From all the reports we've seen, this president was not happy with this ongoing investigation, not happy with this being a focus. You know, this is a president who likes the headlines to be something that aren't distracting from his agenda and things that he wants to be talking about. And this Russia investigation that seems ongoing, you know, and ratcheting up, frankly. You know, you had James Comey going to members, key members of the Senate to say that they're seeking increased resources and going to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to say that they needed some more resources as they were significantly ramping up this investigation. The timing on this and what Republicans would be saying is that even Republicans on Capitol Hill are saying that the timing is suspicious.
Yeah. Well, we heard from members of the King Committee, Angus King, that in fact the committee that was behind this in Congress, behind this investigation, was feeling that they needed more resources. I think the phrase was, he said, we need more people with legal backgrounds in subpoenas.
Well, that's something that's been an issue from the beginning on the Senate intelligence side, that they need more investigators. They need more lawyers. Yeah. They need people who know how to dig and where to find things. Yeah. That's a separate issue than whether or not the FBI needs more. But I think that what the unintended consequence here of what President Trump did in firing James Comey was, if he was trying to squash this investigation, now it's just going to burn a much hotter, brighter spotlight on it.
Do you think there's an attempt by the White House to dim that light? There's other news today that the White House will announce a commission on voter fraud. President Trump has long contended that millions voted illegally. No evidence of that. You have a sense of trying to swing the spotlight?
Well, anything related to voter fraud is going to come back to Russia and come back to the campaign and how that was conducted. So, you know, they're all kind of intertwined. This is something that the president promised to do. Vice President Pence is supposed to be tasked with heading this up. But again, anything related to that is just going to come back to Russia.
And could come back to haunt them. NPR political editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
Thank you.
Before James Comey was fired, Washington was talking about something else, the Republican plan to overhaul health care. A compromise amendment introduced by a congressman from New Jersey secured enough votes to get the bill through the House. And that congressman, Republican Tom MacArthur, returned to his district last night to hold a town hall meeting, and he got an earful from voters opposed to the GOP's alternative to Obamacare called the American Health Care Act. Joe Hernandez from Here Now contributor WHYY was there.
Hundreds of protesters crowded the sidewalk outside a community center in Willingboro, a South Jersey Democratic stronghold near Philadelphia. Their message to Congressman Tom MacArthur was simple. We don't want this health care bill that your amendment made possible. Some protesters held a die-in, lying on the ground with cardboard tombstones, many of which read, "Shame on you." Another protester was dressed as the Grim Reaper.
It's not America. You don't let people die so that the billionaires can get richer and richer.
Tammy Bobrin of Cinnaminson, New Jersey, called it unconscionable to strip health care away from some people and give a tax cut to others. And for Bobrin, who says she has cancer, opposition to the Republican health care plan is personal.
Like, if I lose my coverage, I'm going to die. My chemotherapy costs $43,000 a week. I don't have $43,000 a week.
Robert Clark of Whiting, New Jersey, was waiting in line to get inside the town hall. He's worried he'll lose Medicaid coverage if the bill passes. And he says Republicans like MacArthur just don't seem to care about voters who oppose the plan.
You know, this is kind of a new age of democracy in America with Trump as president, where, you know, the politicians just ignore the people and do what they want. You know, Tom MacArthur's a millionaire. He doesn't care about little people.
Folks, please.
Inside the meeting, MacArthur began by talking about his daughter, Grace. She was born with a disability and died at age 11. He said he knows what it's like to struggle with illness and the high cost of health care, but members of the crowd did not want to hear it.
I'm not going to tell you all about Grace's life, because obviously you've read that to the point you don't care. But I will say this. No, it's not all I say. It's not all I say.
MacArthur started taking questions, and right away he was asked about his amendment to the Republican health care bill. When one audience member wanted to know why MacArthur would let insurers charge higher premiums to people with pre-existing conditions, he had this to say.
My commitment has been and continues to be, and I hope you'll see this as we talk about this particular issue, that nobody with a pre-existing condition will either be declined coverage or be priced out of being able to buy insurance. Let me finish. Well, folks.
In fact, MacArthur's amendment would allow insurers to jack up prices for people with pre-existing conditions under certain circumstances, but it would also force some states to create high-risk pools to help cover the costs of sicker patients. His amendment would also let states get a waiver to avoid covering the so-called essential health benefits enshrined in the Affordable Care Act. MacArthur spent 30 years working in the insurance industry. His first job out of college was as an insurance adjuster in New York City. He says he's pushing this bill now because he sees a failing health insurance system and wants to try to preserve it for future generations.
You can disagree, but I am trying to do what I can to save a health insurance market that is collapsing. That's what I'm trying to do.
It was MacArthur's amendment that convinced the few dozen members of the conservative House Freedom Caucus to vote for the bill. That fact did not endear him to the crowd.
When are you going to decide to be an American and not a politician?
But MacArthur said that for every Democrat in his district, there's a Republican who thinks differently, and that he went to Congress to try to represent them and solve problems.
And whenever the people of South Jersey don't think I'm doing that, I won't be there. That's just the reality of it. That's the reality of it.
MacArthur took questions for about 5 hours on a range of topics. He said despite the firing of FBI Director James Comey, the public should be patient and wait for the Bureau to finish its investigation into Russian meddling in the presidential election. He also said President Trump should release his tax returns, but MacArthur would not support a law forcing him to do it. But the vast majority of the town hall was a discussion about health care, which could take a new shape in the coming weeks or months. The House bill is expected to undergo some serious changes in the Senate. For Here and Now, I'm Joe Hernandez.
All this week, we're talking about privatization in America, and today we're taking a look at the privatization of public space and how it's changing our cities. Gerald Caden is a professor of urban planning and design at Harvard University. He joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you wrote the book on privately owned public spaces, which actually has a specific meaning in urban planning circles. Tell us what that means, privately owned public space.
Privately owned public spaces are small plazas, arcades, and other outdoor and indoor spaces that are provided in an unusual way. Developers of office and residential towers are allowed to build bigger buildings if they agree in return to provide these privately owned public spaces, normally in front of their buildings or inside on the first floor.
Are they taking away space that was public space before? Is that why they have to make this deal?
It's entirely on private property. They are not taking away anything. They're getting something that is financially valuable to them, and in return, they're providing something of value to society as a whole.
And is this a new idea?
It's not a new idea. It started in New York City in 1961, although people in Chicago argue, no, our city did it first several years earlier. But it really started in New York City, plazas and arcades, 1961, and now there are over 540 of these privately owned public spaces in New York, and it's spread around the world, San Francisco, Vancouver, Toronto, Seoul, South Korea, Tokyo, Japan, and many other cities around the world.
And what was the reason for it?
The reason was this notion of almost a free lunch. Cities and their budgets are and were increasingly squeezed, and this would be a good way to get public space for free without the city allocating any of its land or any of its money. Let's have the private sector provide all of these wonderful spaces. And also, they were smaller spaces scattered about, an archipelago in a city as opposed to Central Park. In New York City, for example, if you aggregated all of these privately owned public spaces together, they would cover 10% of Central Park, but they're scattered throughout the city.
Hmm. But there's no such thing as a free public space, I guess, to change a well-known saying. What's the downside of this?
The downside is that you have the fox guarding the hen house. So the developers and owners of these buildings provided these spaces not necessarily and really not because they loved public space and wanted to serve the public. They wanted these zoning concessions that delivered financial value to them. So when the public started to use these spaces, these owners said, well, we don't really want the public on these spaces. And too often they privatized these public spaces. And they did it through denial of access. So they would say, sorry, this isn't a public space. Or they'd keep it closed when it was supposed to be open. Or they'd allow adjacent private uses to annex the public space, what I sometimes call cafe creep, or brasserie bulge, or trotteria trickle.
Hmm.
And I'm not against cafes, but it makes people have to pay to enjoy public space, which violates one of the central tenets of public space.
This also came up in the Occupy Wall Street protests in New York, because Zuccotti Park in New York is one of these privately owned public spaces, right?
Yes. This is actually a very interesting example that demonstrates that the identity of the owner, being either government or private, doesn't always determine the publicness of the space. So yes, Zuccotti Park, occupied by Occupy Wall Street, was indeed one of these privately owned public spaces. In other words, it was privately owned. And yet the requirements on the owner were to keep the space open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Several blocks to the north, City Hall Park, immediately below City Hall, actually shuts down every evening from dusk to dawn. So in fact, Occupy Wall Street was very smart to occupy a privately owned public space rather than a publicly owned city park.
What about parks aside? Another example of this is malls. In a lot of cities, the mall is the central place in the city where you can go and shop or walk around and hang out, whatever. But it also is private.
For many years, urban planners and real estate people have observed that malls replaced the main street.
Right.
Now, the main street had a publicly owned street, a publicly owned sidewalk, and now that was being replaced by a shopping mall, which was completely privately owned and completely privately controlled. And in the main, that's true. Now, if you're going to have commercial activities, you have to allow some degree of publicness, but they still feel private. Under the California Constitution, individuals have a right to free speech in malls, assuming the malls are public. That's quite interesting as an intrusion on private property, and yet it's guaranteed by the California Constitution.
So what's the effect of all of this, the privatization of these public spaces in America?
The privatization of the public realm, I think, at the end of the day, results potentially in a feeling that we're not really all in this together, that there's not a level playing field. There are areas for wealthier people, and then there are areas for poorer people. I mean, the signature element of public space is that it is open to all, regardless of income, regardless of status, with a relative lack of interference, a sense of possibility, a sense of freedom. Even disagreements are all right, because that's the nature of society that goes beyond family or company, that everybody is involved. That gets harmed or reduced when people no longer feel that public spaces are truly public.
Is there any move afoot to move us back in the other direction?
Right now, I think the answer is no. I think the decision has been made by governments and by people that the tension between providing privately provided public space is simply the answer to shrinking public budgets. When you have public spending on parks reducing year to year to year at local, state, and national levels, then the question is, how do we get these public spaces? And the answer seems to be, in part, at least with regard to parks, that we empower local groups, friends of, state groups, national groups, conservancies, to raise money from private donors to pay for public space. That's a great thing in many ways. And the public spaces may, in fact, to some degree, look better, operate better. But at the same time, there's a feeling of loss of public control, a ceding of control to these private donors who understandably want some degree of control in return for their contribution.
That's Gerald Caden, who's a professor of urban planning and design at Harvard University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And it's not just parks and city streets, but also roads and bridges that are getting more private through public-private partnerships. Joining us now is Eduardo Engel, professor of economics at the University of Chile. He studies the issue around the world. And professor, in general, are we seeing more privately owned or operated infrastructure in the U.S.?
We are seeing an increase, but more importantly, we're seeing the possibility of a huge increase over the coming years based on one of the campaign promises of President Trump, which is to spend $1 trillion on new infrastructure and revamping existing infrastructure.
What do we already have in this country when it comes to privatized public space or infrastructure?
There's a significant amount of private participation, but there are, in some sectors, and let's talk to specifically about transportation, states that go into debt to finance new roads, to finance new highways. The amount of public-private partnerships has been growing over the last 10, 20 years, but the initial base is very small, so that even though growth has been fast, still as a fraction of the total, it's a small number.
So give me an example.
So there's two major highways in the U.S. in the 1990s, the Dulles Greenway near Washington, D.C., and Orange County, SR 91 near Orange County and close to LA, which were two public-private partnerships. In one case, it was a lane of approximately 10 miles. Another case was a tolled lane besides two untolled lanes near California, Orange County.
And is there a problem with that?
Well, if you look at the worldwide experience, and it's also been in the U.S., these are long-term contracts. Basically, a private firm builds a road, finances, and then has 20, 30, 40 years, sometimes even more than that, to recuperate its investment by charging user fees, by charging tolls, and sometimes also by receiving some subsidies from government. And in this long period, there's a lot of opportunity for renegotiating the original contract. When you have the traditional approach, you come, you build, and then you leave. And so there's little opportunity for renegotiations of contracts. But the big downside with public-private partnerships has been a lot of renegotiations, often to the detriment of taxpayers, to the detriment of users who end up paying more. But that has been the downside with public-private partnerships and is the one reason why you should be careful about how you do it.
And I guess the upside would be you don't have to spend as much taxpayer money.
Well, that's what everyone believes, but it's not correct because it's true you don't spend money at the beginning because you don't build it, but then you give up the chance of charging tolls, which you would have done otherwise. You take those two and it cancels out unless under a public-private partnership you're more efficient. But what you can get is much better maintenance. And if you look at maintenance of U.S. infrastructure, in particular transportation infrastructure, it's not great, and that happens in many, many countries. The politics of maintenance is not good. It's much more attractive for a politician to inaugurate a new highway, a new infrastructure project, than to maintain properly an existing project, which is not the case under a public-private partnership. In those cases, if you write the correct contract, there are very strong incentives to maintain correctly, and also evidence shows that maintenance is much better.
That's Eduardo Engel, a professor of economics at the University of Chile in Santiago. He's the co-author of a new book called The Economics of Public-Private Partnerships. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jerry.
And tomorrow, our series on privatization concludes with a look at the privatization of our digital lives. The Department of Homeland Security is considering expanding its ban on large electronics in plane cabins, according to reports today. Right now, the ban covers flights to the U.S. from 10 airports in the Middle East and North Africa, but an expanded ban would include flights to the U.S. from Europe. Here to take a look at this is Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
And we should say this is a ban like on laptops. You can't bring on these flights right now a laptop into the cabin with you. Mm-hmm. Why do we think that they want to expand this to Europe?
Yeah, so it's laptops, cameras, tablets, so anything really bigger than a cell phone. And for the same reason, so that they put the ban in place in those 10 majority Muslim countries in the first place. And that's because intelligence had indicated that ISIS was developing a way to put explosives into these devices and bring them onto planes. And so the concern is now that anybody trying to do that would actually just go to Europe first and then fly to the U.S.
Hmm. And if there was some kind of an explosive inside one of these devices, wouldn't that be caught by the security scanners?
You would think, right? But this is sort of a little bit of a technological arms race. And the U.S. government has been studying this, has done tests, and has found fake explosives hidden in laptops. They've seen cases where it does get through security scanners. Now, what the airlines say is, well, maybe we should just swab everything that goes through. So swab every laptop, every tablet. Mm-hmm. European airline regulators are worried about actually putting all those devices into the cargo hold because they say that can increase risk of a fire. So there are concerns about putting this kind of ban into place.
There are also concerns on the part of the airlines because a lot of the people that want to bring these devices on board are business travelers.
Yeah.
And if they have the choice of flying another airline where they can bring the device on board, they're going to do that rather than fly Emirates or Qatar Airways or one of these. What's been the impact on the airlines from the original ban?
Yeah, so Emirates, which is based in Dubai, has actually seen reduced demand, and they have cut 20% of their flights to the United States, and they have blamed these measures. And I have talked to executives who say that they have changed their flights. People fly like three times a month, you know, from Asia to the U.S. in first class so they can get work done. Mm-hmm. They've actually changed airlines so that they can bring their laptops with them. But now this is going to restrict that if they can't go through Europe, which is a major, major transit point.
Isn't there also a concern, though, about putting these devices in the cargo hold? Because many of them have lithium-ion batteries, which have been known to start fires.
Exactly. And so that's a risk that European regulators have raised. That's something that airlines also say. And the other thing is, like, passengers don't want to do that. You don't want to put your laptop into a checked bag and then see it tossed on the tarmac, you know, and come up those conveyor belts. So it's going to disrupt just how passengers enjoy flying nowadays.
And I imagine we're going to hear some reaction from the airlines if this new ban is put on flights coming in from Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. This would just affect a lot more. They're calling it a logistical mess. Airlines are good at handling logistics. I'm sure they can figure it out. But I think the bigger issue is just what do people do if they can't bring laptops on planes, especially those people who are really paying the big money for those seats.
That's Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Kurt, thank you.
You got it.
The real estate firm Kushner Companies apologized this week for that sales pitch it made to Chinese investors considering a project in New Jersey. Nicole Kushner Meyer invoked the name of her brother, Jared Kushner, of course, President Trump's son-in-law and close advisor, and critics cried foul, conflict of interest. In addition, flyers for the event said, invest $500,000 and immigrate to the U.S. And a key part of the pitch was the EB-5 visa, which gives foreigners a path to live in the U.S. if they invest big money in business projects. Now, the EB-5 program has long been controversial. Now it's under the spotlight again. And White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said it's under review along with all other visa programs. So let's get a primer on some of them from Hiroshi Motomura with us by Skype. He's a professor of immigration and citizenship at UCLA School of Law and author of the book Immigration Outside the Law. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So start with the EB-5 visas. They've been getting a lot of attention lately, but what exactly do they do?
Well, EB-5 visas is a form of getting a green card or what's called lawful permanent residence in the United States. It's a way to immigrate to the country legally, and it requires people who want to immigrate to make an investment. And the investment could be $1 million, but that number is reduced to $500,000 in certain areas that are rural or have high unemployment or other economic disadvantage.
Right. And, of course, the accusation by critics of the EB-5 visas is that people are fudging that. First of all, a lot of these projects aren't in areas that people might see as rural, certainly, or with a lot of unemployment.
Well, that's true. But you have to think about really how these things are zoned. In other words, you can have a big city project and the people around the country might think of it, oh, it's in a big city and that's not a high unemployment area. But it turns out that it does create jobs for people in close by high unemployment areas and allows them to commute in and work.
And the requirement is that the person who invests in and then receives the EB-5 visa, their investment has to create at least 10 jobs. Look, it's seen as a way for foreigners to buy citizenship.
Well, you could think of it, I suppose, or characterize it as buying your way into the country. But, you know, of course, it's all a matter of characterization. This is also a way to attract investment in the United States and to create jobs for American workers.
Well, as we said, there are critics. Senators Dianne Feinstein and Chuck Grassley, she a Democrat, he a Republican, have co-sponsored a bill to end the program because of concerns that this is just selling citizenship at a very high level. And we understand more than 80% of those who get the EB-5 visas are Chinese, so there are concerns there. And it just got renewed late last week.
There are different issues here, right? One is whether there ought to be an investor visa at all. The second issue is how it's run. The third is the recent controversy regarding Jared Kushner. And the fourth is the concentration of recipients in China. A lot of the objections have to do with the fact that there is, in some sense, it looks like buying your way into the country. But I think one of the important things to remember is that this is also job creation. And so some people are concerned that people with certain means can get into the country. But it's in some ways, it's not that different from the fact that there are many legal ways to get into the country if you have a college degree and you can pay for an attorney, which has obviously some financial requirements to be able to pay.
Let's move on to the H-1B visas. These allow foreigners who work in specialty occupations, that's technology, engineering, math, business, to work in the country for 3 years. They can renew those visas as long as they remain employed. Talk more about the H-1B visa.
Well, the H-1B visa is also, like other some of the other visa programs, become controversial. It's a program that does not necessarily lead to permanent residence in the United States, and therefore does not necessarily lead to citizenship. There's been concern about some H-1B workers displacing American workers, but in many cases, the alternative to that kind of dynamic would be for the company itself to entirely go overseas, and that really wouldn't help the U.S. job situation at all. So I think a lot of the solutions really lie not so much in preventing the H-1B program, but making sure that it operates the way Congress intended it to operate. And the other is to provide other forms of relief and retraining and education for U.S. workers that may feel that they're displaced.
Yeah. President Trump has been both for and against the H-1B visas. He really was against them in the campaign. But then he wrote on his website, "I'm softening the position because we have to have talented people in this country." But then he hardened it again, saying, "I will end forever the use of the H-1B as a cheap labor program and institute an absolute hire American workers first program, no exceptions." So we're a little all over the place on that. But who would react the most if we got rid of the H-1B visas? Is this Silicon Valley?
That general economic sector has been, I guess you would say, a heavy user of H-1B visas. But, you know, I don't think we should stereotype it exactly to that. I mean, the H-1B program is also essential in smaller numbers for all kinds of industries. It does require, generally speaking, a college degree. And it's a situation where H-1B workers could be used for teachers, for example, and a lot of people with training. And so all kinds of American employers benefit from having temporary workers, whether it's a business or university.
By the way, the H-1Bs are capped at 85,000. You can't give out more than that. Talk about the H-2 visas. These are the seasonal worker visas, agricultural workers or waiters or housekeepers. And it seems odd because it requires that employers have to prove that they couldn't fill these positions with American citizens. But when you look around any vacation area, you know, you wonder if they could.
Well, H-2 programs, they fall into two categories. There's the H-2A program in agriculture. There's the H-2B program and everything else. And so they are, in theory, for people who are taking jobs that for which there's a shortage of U.S. workers. The idea here is to fill those jobs that then allow, for example, a hotel to keep operating or a farm to keep operating because American workers aren't available in sufficient numbers. Now, I think the counter argument to that has always been, well, if you paid more, then you would get American workers to be housekeepers or to pick crops. The difficulty there is that that would increase the prices to American consumers in such a way that, for example, people wouldn't buy the strawberries, and in fact, the farm would go out of business and the strawberries would be brought in from another country. So this is yet another example of operating a global economy. I think one of the things to remember about the H-2A and the H-2B programs is that these are for people who, generally speaking, don't have college degrees. They're not professionals. They're working in farm labor. They're working, for example, as housekeepers or in landscape. And what you have here is one of the very few ways to come to this country legally if you don't have a college degree.
Well, we should say that according to the Washington Post, Donald Trump's vineyard in Charlottesville, Virginia, applied for 6 H-2A visas. That's for the agriculture. And also Mar-a-Lago, apparently the resort in Florida, requested 78 H-2B visas for servers, housekeepers, cooks, and the like. And that Donald Trump, when asked about this at a debate during the campaign, said, "It's very, very hard to get people, but other hotels do the exact same thing. There's nothing wrong with it. We have no choice." And it goes to show that when you need them, you know, when this serves your business, you are usually for these visas.
Right. So I think that this is an example of the economic needs of this country. And one of the fundamental problems with the U.S. economic and immigration systems, if you look at them together, is there's a mismatch between the economic system and the immigration system. The U.S. economy has a great need for workers all up and down the education and training spectrum, people who don't have formal educations, people who have PhDs, But the immigration system makes it very difficult to come to the United States to work if you don't have a college degree. There is no line to stand in for those jobs.
Well, we just mentioned in passing, there's also the H-1B3, the model visa, which allows, it's sort of a subset of highly skilled workers visa. It allows people in the modeling industry to come. There's the O-1, the artist or genius visa. This is athletes, musicians, famous authors, others who may come in. If you're coming for a specific competition, that's a P-1 athlete's visa. And there's, of course, the F-1, which is the student visas. Look, can a president just withdraw a visa? How do you take away a visa or the possibility of one?
Well, at one level, Congress defines the category. So any president has to work within that congressional structure or ask Congress to change it. But then every administration has the opportunity to refine some of the requirements and also to apply the requirements in any individual case.
Fascinating. Hiroshi Motomura, professor of immigration and citizenship at UCLA School of Law, author of the book Immigration Outside the Law, taking a look at the many visas there are. Professor Hiroshi, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Engineers at the Oroville Dam in Northern California are about to start rebuilding two giant spillways that collapsed after heavy rains in February. State water officials also promise a full forensic review of the near-catastrophic failures that forced mass evacuations along the Feather River. That includes a hard look at the geology underlying the spillways, something that appears to have gotten short shrift when the dam was built 50 years ago. Craig Miller from Here and Now contributor KQED reports.
To get to the bottom, literally, of Oroville's complex geology, you have to go to Timbuktu, literally. That's a remnant of a gold mining town in Yuba County, about 15 miles south of Oroville.
Okay, so we're looking eastward at the western slope of the Sierras.
I'm with Eldridge Moores, the legendary geologist from UC Davis, who is one of the world's leading experts on the geology of the Sierra foothills.
I'm looking at the traffic, and you're looking at rocks.
Right.
We stop at a road cut along Highway 20.
Aha. Okay, here we go, right here.
It turns out that road cuts are convenient windows into the Sierra's creation story. California's signature mountain range is a jumble of volcanic rock, some transported from the mid-ocean floor and piled up at the edge of the continent more than 150 million years ago, with newer intrusions of molten rock or magma that nosed its way upward in columns called sheeted dikes.
What we see as we walk along here on this road cut, we see the alternation of lighter-colored material and the darker material. The darker fine-grained material are dikes.
It's like a multi-decker magma sandwich.
It's a vertical magma sandwich. That's exactly what it is.
But what really mattered at Oroville was less the kind of rock than the condition of it. We walked down to a spot on the Yuba River where the rocks are similar to those at the dam site. Two rocks sit side by side. One is a bluish-gray and smooth. Geologists call that fresh rock. The other is brown and fractured. That's called weathered rock.
The fresh rock has been combined with the atmosphere, and when that happens, you get this chemical change, and you produce this softer sort of rock that's falling apart. Hear that?
Yeah.
Hear the difference?
It's like rotten wood.
It's like rotten wood, yeah. That rock is resistant to water pouring over it. This is not. Just dig it. It's almost like dirt. It's almost like dirt. It's on its way to becoming dirt.
Engineers call that incompetent rock. And that, says Moores, is what Oroville's main concrete spillway was built on and what the emergency spillway was made of. In February, as intense storms filled the reservoir, both spillways began disintegrating under the force of billions of gallons of water cascading over them.
If you erode this, you dump your overflow into rocks like this. Of course you're going to erode them.
A 1961 planning document says the dam site is, quote, blessed with a geologic structure and foundation rock, which are suitable for the foundation. It also suggests excavating down 18 feet to clear away, quote, soil and weathered rock for the main body of the dam. So it's clear that builders working for the State Department of Water Resources were aware of the incompetent rock that's prevalent at the site.
It's not like this would have been any different when they built the dam.
It was not any different when they built the dam. No, no, that takes, in fact, some of these soils, in fact, may be millions of years old.
Back in Davis, looking at geological maps and aerial photos of the dam and shredded spillways, one thing becomes clear to Moores.
They did not anchor the spillway in fresh rock.
Consequently, the emergency spillway quickly disintegrated, with water tumbling over it at little more than 12,000 cubic feet per second, though design documents anticipated it might have to handle flows of at least 20 times that.
I find that astounding, that they would rate it like that. I mean, again, I don't know about these ratings, but it seems to me that even a student of geology could have told them that they were going to have an erosion problem here.
Despite several requests, California's Department of Water Resources did not provide an expert interview for this story. In a statement, the agency said only that the dam and spillway, quote, met the design and construction standards of its time half a century ago. Knowing what he does about the geology of the Sierra, I asked Moores what it tells him about the other dams around the state of similar design and siting.
I worry. That's what it tells me about the rest of the dams.
In late February, Governor Jerry Brown ordered new detailed inspections of state dams with similar spillways, and state officials have promised a full forensic review of the Oroville incident sometime in the fall. For Here and Now, I'm Craig Miller.
And we want to take a moment now to acknowledge an anniversary. On May 11th, 1987, 30 years ago today, NPR first broadcast the program Fresh Air with the great Terry Gross, who has done so many terrific interviews over the years.
Jeremy, you know, occasionally someone compliments me on something I know I didn't do, but Terry did. And you know what I say? Thank you.
Take the credit.
Yeah, thank you, Terry and crew.
And today, if you want, you can talk about your favorite Fresh Air moments with the hashtag FreshAir30. There are so many.
Oh, yeah.
Including that time Bill O'Reilly walked out of the interview.
Okay.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.